Welcome to this episode of Bioethics for the People, the most popular podcast on the planet, according to Grandma Nancy. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Tyler Gibb, who, if he weren't here recording right now, would probably be golfing.
And I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Devin Stahl, who dutifully completes the same 5 New York Times puzzles every day.
All right, good morning, Tyler.
Good morning.
We have a special guest with us today who's going to tell us another success story. Are you tired of success stories yet, or are you really like into success?
You know what? I really like the stories where things go off the rails and everything is a disaster. The pandemic was my favorite part of my life so far, because everything was falling off the rails. No, none of that is true. So yes, the success story series is going well. Amazing stories from people. And what I really love is that some of them are completely out of left field, right? Like the way that we think about clinical ethics is kind of being expanded through some of these stories. So,
Absolutely. All right. So today we had a volunteer who comes out of the best state, or at least one of the biggest states.
Wait, so I don't know what state he's coming from.
Okay.
Are you going to say Texas?
I'm going to say Texas.
But I was born and raised partly in Michigan. So, you know.
I have a colleague who said that he would never go to war for the United States, but he would go to war for Michigan.
Sounds like something a Texan would say about Texas.
Yeah, it's exactly what I thought.
Have you ever seen the bumper sticker that says, "I'm smitten with the mitten"?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. There's a lot of cleverness that goes on in bumper stickers in the shape of Michigan. So
there it is.
By Peninsular and Proud is another one that I'm a big fan of.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Very good.
Okay. What are we talking about today? Oh. Okay. So you're from Texas, apparently.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
In Texas now, right? All right. So Stephen, please introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Stephen Squires. I've worked in Catholic healthcare for about 18 years as an ethicist, mostly system. I have done a lot of regional work. I've been a local mission leader, which is the position that is about the identity of the institution in Catholic healthcare. So I've done that. So in other words, I've worked in a hospital, so I do know somewhat of how it goes. But I've done a lot of system ethics as well. I've worked for Bon Secours Mercy Health and Trinity Health, based out of Michigan. Both are large coast-to-coast Catholic healthcare systems. And I interned a little bit with Ascension Health, and now I'm here at Christus Health, based out of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And specifically, as you can see in back of me, I'm in Irving, which, if you could see back far enough, Dallas is back there in the skyline. So as far as my background goes, I started as a bio pre-med major in college, and you know, a few organic chemistry scores can dash your hopes of becoming a physician really quickly if you don't do well.
Was that organic chemistry?
Yes, it was. Yeah. O-chem. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I've heard this story before.
I did not do well. So, but it does get you thinking, because I had a lot of physicians say at the time, well, you don't need to be a physician to make a difference in healthcare. And some of them even referred to ethics by name, which got me kind of thinking. My life took somewhat of a different track because I was also passionate about education. So I got a master's in education, and I worked for a little while in colleges, particularly in residence life and admissions and things like that. And then I decided to make a pivot to try and go into healthcare ethics. Got a master's at Loyola. Found I couldn't get a job with a master's because people would say, well, are you a doctor? No. Are you a lawyer? No. Well, I don't know what we can do. So I went ahead and got the doctorate. And that was, I think, in 2012. So that's the short narrative. Married 3 kids. Oldest is going to college this next year. She's a senior in high school. So we're looking that whole thing, and he's looking at rice, which I suppose is good. I just cough a little bit when I see the tuition, but
Well, you got to spend money on something, and it might as well
that's right.
be
That's right.
education of your kids. Okay. All right. So good. So now you're working at Christus in Dallas, and
Yes.
tell us a little bit about Christus, large, small. I assume it's a Catholic organization, and then what your role is within that system.
Yes. So Christus is a, I would say, medium to large Catholic healthcare system. There's over 40 hospitals just in the U.S. alone. Recently, we merged and are working with are the parent company of a new hospital in New Mexico. And we also have hospitals in three other countries. So we're not just US based, we're also in other countries. And I believe when you incorporate the presence of the other countries, that's what makes us so large. It's just you may not see it because the main three states we're in are Texas, Louisiana, and New Mexico. We're a little bit into Arkansas. I don't know if there's any hospital there, but it's mainly the southern US.
Gotcha. And your role is as the system director of ethics, or how do you describe your role?
Yes, I'm vice president of ethics. So I'd say ultimately, ethics is my responsibility throughout the system. As I'm sure and as a lot of ethics roles are, the majority of my time is spent either as a backup to the backup to the backup of cases or working with policy. But I find a large part of what I do, which is even later today, I'm doing an ethics consult training for folks who are in, we have a hospital in Santa Fe. And so we've got a group of folks who want to be ethics consultants. And so that's part of what I do is by we'll do a training there in person. I Zoom in or I Teams in, and we'll do trainings about certain things. So we've got lots of education within the system. Like we have ethics webinars, which I hope to get you two involved with as continuing education. We have modules that are online for whenever somebody becomes a new ethics program member, so whether a committee member or consultant. And then we have a specialty consultation training, which is like today, and they get practice in doing cases. So we'll actually go through the method, go through some good interpersonal skills, and then we'll try out some cases.
Great.
Yeah. So today, though, you have a, is it a case for us or a policy for us? Sort of what is your latest success or what came top of mind when we said, hey, we would love some success stories?
So the thing that came top of mind for me is this in my mind, a success story can be a process that's shown demonstrated success. And I think for me, one of the things that I've always scratched my head at in bioethics is how we're so inclusive of people from every single different field because it's kind of a, I don't know if I want to say add-on, but it's like you come with kind of whatever your base knowledge is, and then ethics is something you get kind of a super specialty in. And one of the things I haven't seen a lot of, I don't think, is people out of education proper. Now, I'm not talking about professors. My guess is if you look at the Constitution of or the composition of the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities, we've got a lot of academics. What my question would be is, do we have a lot of those academics coming with a background in education, like an EdD or a PhD in education? So I think part of my question and my intrigue, being somebody who has a degree in education, is if this is the majority of what we do, and I know of at least one survey of ethicists that said, what do you do mostly with your time? And the ethicist said, by and large, in practice, it's education. And so my question is, why isn't there more method into how we do that? Because education has methods, and I think maybe an underlying assumption is, well, yeah, but that's for higher education. Those methods are for schools. Well, not necessarily. I mean, education is whatever setting that takes place in if there's an information exchange. So, born out of that, that's kind of the backdrop to me saying I would like to be a lot more intentional on how education works within our system, definitely. In general, I'm working on some things with the Catholic Health Association right now with education. But also, why are we so this is the second part of the genesis of it. Why are we so stuck in especially lunch and learns?
We love a
That's a,
lunch and learn.
yeah, I think there's room for them, and I've backtracked a lot because I've said, gone are the days of lunch and learns, and somebody corrected me to say, no, they still have a place.
It seems to me that lunch and learn is like the hour of the day where you're most likely to get the most amount of clinicians, although I don't know that that's actually true or false. But and then it seems like ethics education, like a lot of education, is like any place that we can get any kind of face time, we're willing to take it, even if it's not a great
Yes.
educational environment, right? So I've been
Yes.
asked to give a lecture at like 6 o'clock in the morning to transplant surgeons, and I was like, no, I don't even want to talk about ethics at 6 in the morning to people who are coming off of shift, right? So that makes a lot of sense to me. So
Does it start with a weary eye? Do whatever you want, you know. Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think now here are the things. I think you're right in the sense of, well, where else are you going to get people? Are you going to get people on their lunch break before their day really starts? So, like prior to the shift or right at the beginning of the shift or at shift end. But where I'm going with this is there, I have seen just in when I was, much, much more day to day in hospitals. When we would do something like a moral distress rounds, Schwartz Center rounds, the people who could come in the beginning, and now this is quite a few years pre-pandemic, I saw that drop off just because in a certain amount of time, nurses really only have 30 minutes for lunch. So if you've got an hour program, they have to make accommodations to stay most of the time, and now a lot of them can't. And then when you're in a classroom, like in a classroom that's in the hospital, that takes people off the floors to go to that classroom, which is generally fairly removed from where they are, and then they have to get back. And so if you look at a nurse going to get lunch, that takes, sometimes 5 minutes in the line or in the lunchroom, just to get that 5 minutes to walk over, you've already done away with 10 or 15 minutes. So that really started captivating my attention is, yeah, lunch and learns will often get physicians who have kind of an hour they can juggle with. It's less and less we get nurses. Sometimes we can get chaplains, we can get social workers, but it kind of depends. So my big thing is if you're not doing it at lunch, if it's tough to do it sometimes at the beginning and the end of the shift, what are we looking at that we could do that's embedded in other things? And Ty, I think you made the comment like, well, we'll take whatever we can get. Yeah, that's true, but can we take that and make it really good, sometimes even independent of setting? And my contention is yes. And so that's why I developed what I was proposing to talk about today, which is called stat ethics.
That ethics. Okay.
That's the name because, we don't have enough acronyms in healthcare.
Uh-oh.
Oh, StatEthics stands for short, timely, applicable, and team-based.
Is that what STAT stands for when doctors yell STAT?
No.
Yeah, probably not.
All right,
I
so stat
yeah.
ethics. Okay. And this is an educational kind of format framework that you came up with, you and your team. I don't know who's involved, but to address this need of being able to give high quality ethics education in a situation where we don't have a lot of time or the setting maybe not within our control.
Yes,
Okay,
correct.
great.
And
So.
it's largely based on adult learning styles because it's very much of a misnomer that because we're all with very educated people. I mean, most social workers have at least a master's. Most, us, we have doctorates and MDs are doctors. And we're dealing with people who have high levels of education for the most part. Right. We sometimes people have their bachelor's and things like that. All fine. But I think the go-to thought is that people generally learn like you do in a classroom. And that's not necessarily true. Adult learning theory and adult learning styles will tell us that adults can learn in very short bursts, like 10 minutes, 15 minutes. It has to be relevant, extremely relevant to what they do. So don't, my theory is because we're in Catholic healthcare, don't tell me what Aquinas said back in God knows when. Tell me how this is impacting my job now. And you would not believe the amount of times I hear, well, Thomas Aquinas designed this and it was for when people were riding their horses and they trampled over other people and whether it was double effect or whatever. And it's kind of like, yeah, you lost me already.
Yeah, I had a what so my mentor in clinical ethics, he always said that you have to be able to teach it to a trauma surgeon. And not to be disrespectful to trauma surgeons, but it doesn't matter what Aquinas said if you can't give practical advice to somebody who's in the trenches like a trauma surgeon. And I think that's really the key skill of an excellent clinical ethicist is be able to have that background knowledge of all the theory and the history of all of these different topics and concepts, but then translate it into something that a trauma surgeon, for example, can use. So tell us more about this framework. Like, what does it look like? A 10 to 15 minute model, blitz of ethics education.
So we have a little bit more as the background than just the meeting itself. So part of my theory, too, is we've also gotten lost generally that when we talk about ethics education, it never, when you go to things like the Quinlan opinion or the President's Commission, when they talk about it, it never was. The end goal of ethics was for our own education. When I say our, I'm not talking ethicists, I'm talking ethics committee members or ethics consultants. They were never the end game. They were always the conduits. Then why is it then in it? And by this point in my career, I've witnessed thousands. Because if you think about me going to 10 ethics committee meetings a month in, virtually in different settings, I probably witnessed over 1,000 ethics committee meetings. Why is it most of the time when we talk about education, it's talking about educating ourselves, but then that never goes as we're the conduits onto the final goal, which it always was. If you look at Quinlan and the President's Commission, it always was that that's supposed to go out to the clinicians, to the associates, to the community. And so, how much are we not paying attention to that it's kind of to serve us, but then it stops with us? It doesn't really get out anywhere else. And so, that in fact is a huge bottleneck. because there's people out there who are laypersons who probably don't have an ethics degree, that they've got an enormous amount of ethics knowledge that they could probably teach fairly competently on a topic. And this is where the first point about stat ethics I want to get across is we're not asking people to be ethicists. What we're asking is to take a very finely tuned topic and to know the core issues about that topic. I think anybody can do that. I mean, I wouldn't even ask somebody to wade into like NRP now or something like that. What I do think we could do is, and this surfaced from, we had a particular case where it involved somebody who claimed to be the surrogate spokesperson for the children. He was the oldest male, I think, of three, of three children. The other two were younger sisters. And then he was saying kind of interesting things to our staff members. And then the other thing that came up is he was trying to deny his mom from getting pain medicine. But he didn't have any good reason. Like when we would ask, well, tell us about a conversation, tell us about a time when you discussed that, there was nothing. It was just she shouldn't get this. And so I think going back to the topic, that anybody should be able to say, for instance, pain control is a basic right. Unless there's an overriding conversation that, for instance, believing in redemptive suffering, physical suffering, or something like that, there in the absence of that, how can we go against somebody's fundamental right to pain control? Now, you can find out enough about, say, pain control and, say, the surrogacy priority order, or whatever it might be, to address that within a small time period. So that was kind of the first thing is we did when this launched, and I'll describe it in just a second, but when it launched, somebody wanted to do a hybrid between that and a lunch and learn. And so, in essence, what they wanted was this is a 10 or 15 minute format that's within a meeting. So it's like a nursing huddle, and we talk with the nurse supervisor to see if we can get 10 or 15 minutes in that time period. Now, this person wanted to do something that was like an abbreviated lunch and learn. So it was like a 30 minute lunch and learn or, 40 minute or something. And then that person who was trying it out took a huge topic like surrogate decision making. Well, not surprisingly, when that focus group got done, they wanted more. They didn't think it was enough time. But if you look at who it was a small group of physicians, and they had the time, and they had a huge topic, so they wanted to know more. They were curious. That's not what it was made for. So I'll describe it very, very briefly. So the first thing is you need to identify a topic. And a lot of times that comes through a case where you feel like it wasn't optimal in the way it happened. Like we feel like there's some things we could learn from that. The catalyst case I mentioned for this first round of, or the pilot, the second pilot of STAT was the case that I just mentioned. And what we want to do is identify that, then see where the questions were, because in that case, the first questions were with the folks who dealt with the case, but then we heard others say, yeah, but that's interesting. How was, if somebody's saying don't give pain meds, how should we respond? That's a good question. So then we thought, well, it's a broader group than just the folks who dealt with the case. We ask that somebody on the ethics committee appoint like a research and education person, have a point person for that particular topic. That's the person who's going to begin the research for it. We have a form where our IT folks helped us design a form where the way it's done for quality control is the basic method of stat, and this is very simple, 3 to 5 informational points, a very short case, 3 to 5 targeted questions about that case. And ideally, that case should mimic, the case that happened with, altered details and everything. 3 to 5 questions about that case. And then, of course, that's going to generate discussion. And then you leave with 3 to 5 resources. So it's kind of the rule of 3 to 5, right?
Yeah, the classic rule of 3 to 5, which everyone has definitely heard of.
That's right.
That might be on a t-shirt soon.
That's right.
The rule of 3 to 5. Okay, so a case-based prompt or like genesis, and then some questions, some resources that people walk away with. And so what's been your experience utilizing this?
Well, it started, like I said, with that case, and it was kind of perfect the way that one, the genesis of it, because if you were to take that and broaden it, so one of the issues in that case was surrogate decision making. You've got the one guy claiming to speak for all the people at that level. It depends on what state you're in, whether it's the majority of adult children, whether it's an adult child, whatever it might be. But that's certainly something to look into, whereas he claimed to be the person to speak, but is that really accurate? What do the other children think? And we found out later that they did want to be involved. So even that claim of, well, it's just me, later on, it seemed like it was the other family members want involvement. But if you were to take that and say, okay, we need to educate on surrogate decision making. You've now taken a topic that is a fairly focused topic and you've generalized it. So if you're going to go with surrogate decision making, then, you get into, well, does this get into assessing capacity? Does it, what are all the, what about, what's a reasonable amount of time? What's, it can open up this huge thing. Whereas we're really looking at what if one person on the level claims to speak for the whole level? And, how do you question that? Do you question it? And how do you question it? That's what the issue is. So don't generalize it, focus it. So out of that case, I think there became like two or three stat ethics because one was on pain control and pain control being a basic fundamental human right. The other was about a decision-making level for surrogates and one person claiming to speak for everybody when you're not sure that's the case from the hospital side. So the way we did it was we have a form that our IT set up where somebody on the local side types in the 3 to 5 points they think are the most important, gives a case, gives the 3 or 5 questions, and the 3 or 5 resources. Then what we do is we ask them to send the form to us because there's a part where they can put their email. What we ask is to put our email, us meaning ethics at the system level at Christocel. So in other words, having an ethicist kind of just give a second glance over what it is, right? And so then what we do is we take a look at that. Most of the time, it's pretty good. They're just a little fine-tuning things. And we send it back to them, and it arrives as this beautiful PDF because what it does is it has, and I can send you a copy of the format, is it has the topic, and then it has the 3 to 5 points, the case, the questions, and then the resources. So ideally, what we'd like to do over time is to build up a library. Now, it'll probably be a very large library because it's not just, decision-making capacity. It's in this instance and in this instance, but we're trying to build that up so that eventually somebody can just go to the library and say, oh, it's already done. I don't even have to do the little amount of work involved to, you know, make one of these formats. So we send it back to them. They get somebody like a supervisor who can give them time in the meeting format. And for the most part, this is done at nursing huddles. And they get that time, and then they go and they discuss, because other than the 3 to 5 points in the case, it quickly becomes very engaging because you ask these specific questions about the case. And you know, that's how clinicians learn and adults learn, is through cases that are really relevant. So it really is made as a discussion generator. And then, you know, when you close out at the end of all this takes is like 10 minutes. When you close it out, that's when you leave people resources, and they have to be either right there that you can give to them or publicly available. Because again, nurses and physicians and social workers and chaplains don't have access to the resources that the three of us might have as ethicists. So it's got to be something that we've taken a look at and we said, yeah, this is, you know, the it's maybe something from core competencies, or I don't know. But again, that's not, you know, you have to have the book to have it. But maybe it's a website that's a fairly respected source.
A podcast, for example, an episode of a podcast.
If
There
only there were
you
a good bioethics podcast that
go.
really was like educational and entertaining and like anybody could listen to. Somebody should really
Yeah.
make a podcast like that.
I think there's a market for that.
There's a good job with the upsell. I love that. That's great. A podcast on it, you know, something that people can listen to on their way home from work. It's really accessible. So we did that, and the initial results were phenomenal. And by that, I mean we asked three questions about method. So it wasn't necessarily on the topic. Now that we've ensured the method is good, now we're asking questions about the topic. But the method, I asked three questions. Is this method more convenient compared to traditional methods like a lunch and learn? We asked, is this more user-friendly? Now, that's an open term, but is this more user-friendly to you than a traditional method like a lunch and learn in a classroom? And then, is this more helpful to you? And what we got back was shocking, because it was a 5-point Likert scale from stat is much less in all of those factors to stat is much more on the far side.
Yeah, so tell me the things that you measured again. So usefulness, convenience,
It was convenience, user friendliness, and helpfulness.
helpfulness.
We didn't define anything, which it's open for interpretation. But when we got the results back on the Likert scale, it shocked even me. 48 nurses. So this we had, in essence, three kind of little pilots. But when you conglomerate the scores, 48 nurses said, I think the convenience was 74% better than traditional methods. The user friendliness, I believe, was 75% better. And the helpfulness was 76% better. So basically, if somebody told you there's a method you can use for education that is nearly 100% better than anything they've encountered or a traditional method, my question is, why wouldn't you use that?
I consider it at least. Yeah. A hundred
I,
percent better. Well, okay, maybe
yeah.
I'll change the thing that I'm used to doing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I got that back. I'm like, wow, this is really cool, because in essence, we were still reeling, because that first time where somebody wanted to do a hybrid approach, I had to say, but that's not what it's made for. It's not made to be a hybrid of something else. It's made to be this. And we kind of went back and forth. And then I thought, well, let's give it a try and see how it goes. Like I said, it was mostly to physicians, and it was a very general topic, and the timing was longer. Well, people left wanting more because they're in a classroom. They're thinking, this wasn't an hour long. I have an hour long. I have questions. This whole topic wasn't explored. And so in my mind, it made sense why they're like, no, I don't want to go down less time. I want more time. Well, if we had refined the topic more, if we had done it for nurses, if we had done it in the setting, and then I think you'd see a different result. And I would argue that's what we saw.
Yeah, it seems so. A question strikes me that sometimes, like, the customer isn't always right. And what I mean by that is, I don't know that the quality of education is directly tied to the satisfaction of the educated, the person in the classroom. So.
No, good, really good point.
Or that they would know best how to like improve that education if they were felt wanting, right? Like they can assess whether they enjoyed the education, whether they felt like they learned something, whether it was relevant. And I think we should take their word for it, right? Like, ah, no, you really were educated and you didn't even realize it, is probably not the best way to respond to that. But if you said, okay, there was something lacking, how would you fill it? That shouldn't be on the learner. That should be on the educator to think through. Like the learner might have some thoughts that you should listen to, but really it's the educator's job to figure out how to fill that. And the intuition that you just needed more time might not actually be true. It might be that you needed more concentrated education. So it sounds like, yeah, that impulse that you initially had bore fruit, that you either need to do a whole long lunch and learn, or you need to do like these micro stat teachings.
And that's why I'm curious. So on that front, three other Catholic healthcare systems have now picked this up and are trying different versions, trying their own version of it. And I'm really eager. I'd like to get maybe a call together so we can all talk and see how it's going and what the feedback is. Because one system is trying it with their administrators. And I'm wondering, well, how's that going to go? Because this really, I've even resisted saying, is this something we should do for physicians? And maybe part of it is because of that, when I scratch my head because of that first pilot with physicians saying, I want more, this wasn't enough. I guess where I'm going is this has shown the success with groups of nurses and nursing huddles. And so I think whether or not that works with physicians in a different setting, I don't know. We certainly can try, but what seems to work is for nurses on this.
I can even imagine this working for sometimes when I teach just in a undergraduate classroom. I like to open with like, "Hey, this thing happened," or "This thing could have," usually I may make it up. Like, "What if you were the ethicist? What would you do?" And we can't spend 30 minutes on it because I need to get to the rest of the lesson plan that day. I just want a little micro, like, "What's your impulse here? And how would you justify that?" And I need it to be quick because I need to get to the rest of it. Rest of the teaching for the day, but I'd love some like, but they always want to talk about that one thing for like an hour. So this would be a great way to do that too.
I can see it in the medical education setting too, because one of the ways that I like to teach is split up people, students into small groups and give them each an individual case. And then it's only like a, maybe 15 minute and process of analysis. And then they come back and report out what it was. And each one's a unique case. And so all of them get the whole students all group get to the whole class gets to see or hear about six different cases, for example. So seems like it could be very useful in that regard as well.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've always been puzzled by is I don't know how familiar with it you are. There was a model of ethics now, probably 20 years ago, called next generation ethics, which was that, it's supposed to be strategically proactive, integrated, metrics driven, focused on mission and values. Those were the four pillars of it. I think that. This is something where, first of all, my view of how ethics committees go is that particular model started out of ethics committee meetings becoming a philosopher's club. And kind of like you were saying, everybody loves to talk about cases. I mean, there's, in a sense, is there anything wrong with it? I don't know. But in my book, there are certainly a lot of other things we could be covering in a meeting other than rehashing a case that, when you think about it, if the case has already happened, past tense, why are we going over everything over and over? I mean, for people who are familiar with what clinical meetings are, they're very short and to the point. It's like a military briefing. And I kind of get to, but if we've talked about this for an hour, a case that's already done, and we didn't talk policy, and we didn't talk education, and we didn't talk about the patterns that are emerging within the system, we didn't talk about community relations, but what's the outcome to that case? It's already done. So I don't, other than for our own awareness and kind of, talking about and maybe making things a little better for the next time. But I think that's where the next generation method started, was frustration of, but aren't we missing a whole bunch of things if we become kind of a philosopher's club? And let's face it, most of us being not ethicists, being more like doctors and nurses and social workers, if most folks, that isn't really what they do. Again, the question comes back to how much are we serving others versus ourselves in that case? And I'm not trying to be mean, I'm just trying to be realistic in that. So what I think is interesting too is on the case side, when you go to the meeting, the cases should be really minimal. What went well, like a delta, what went well, what didn't, what can we change, that type of deal. The reason I'm mentioning that is because I also resist taking meeting time necessarily to do a lot of education for ourselves, because that can be done in other settings, like a podcast in a car.
Like a podcast in a car.
Podcast in a car.
Yeah.
And I know people who do that. So I mean, they'll listen to an ethics podcast in the car. So have that for your continuing education. Offer your education for ethics program members at a different time, either a podcast they can upload, or we do half an hour kind of quick ethics lunch and learns for all ethics program member continuing education. But the reason I say that is then at the meeting, it can become more operational to, okay, we had this case, here's what's happening culturally, and so here's where we might need to do a stat ethics education. How are we, does anybody want to be point? Even now, as a group, let's think of what are the biggest 3 to 5 things we want to get across. And then how can we alter the case so that it's more anonymous? You can actually use it in an operational sense during ethics committee meeting time if you carve out the space for it. So that's kind of why I got into all that other stuff, is it's like we really should look to clinicians as a model on how to run a very operationally efficient mission. And we need to kind of speed up the pace, or we're going to lose people, because whether we realize it or not, I would say our clinicians operate with like military-like efficiency in what they do.
Yeah, they
So
have to.
that's a lot of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like almost you're flipping the classroom. Use a flipped classroom model for your ethics committee education, giving them the meat of it in the background, and then when they get
Yeah.
into the meeting, they can actually apply it, which is, aligned with a lot of adult education theory as well. So good on
Well,
you, as they say down under.
yeah, I love this, Stephen. I think that's a great intervention. It sounds like the results were really positive, and you were and are a success.
Good.
Very
Yeah.
good. Well,
Good,
the
good.
most powerful motivator I've ever heard is no, you can't do this. And when I first mentioned the idea there was at least one colleague, I think there might have been two, or like, you can't do education that amount of time. End of subject. And I'm like, now because you said that, I'm going to make this work.
Yeah, I see your personality type there.
Well, it's a personality type, but it's also reality, right? Like, I'm thinking then when this person said that, I'm thinking, you know nothing about adult learning, or at least you don't seem to demonstrate anything you know about adult learning. So I think for me, it's what's the kind of new generation or next way that we can work with our clinicians on education?
Great. Well, I think we're gonna have to leave it there, Stephen, but we
Sounds
appreciate
good.
your insights. This new model that you've described sounds like it's going really well. So yeah, keep up the good work, and we'll look to follow what you guys are doing down there in Texas.
Sounds great.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen.
Okay.
Thank
All right.
you.
Bye.
All right. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Bioethics for the People. We can't do it alone, so a huge shout out to Christopher Wright for creating our theme music and to Darian Golden Stahl for designing our logo and all of the artwork. If you're into what we're doing, give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen. And if you're really into what we're doing, head over to bioethicsforthepeople.com to snag some merch.